Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of our radically democratic future.
Today I'd like to dive into some of the challenges coming out of neuroscience. And to start off at the top here, along with malnutrition, violence is one of the major stressors damaging brains in the world. Combine the stressors of war with the other toxins of warfare, and you are certain to end up with damaged brains. Using a technique more sensitive than the MRI, scientists have finally found brain damage in veterans who suffer from the Gulf War syndrome. Using sensitive imaging technology known as magnetic resonance spectroscopy, doctors scanned the brains of both sick and healthy veterans, looking for abnormalities that a regular MRI can't detect. The doctors found that the sick veterans showed evidence of a loss of a chemical called N-acetylaspartate in the brainstem and the basal ganglia. The study was presented at the recent annual meeting of the Radiological Society of North America. Although the capitalist medical industrial complex has an incentive to medicalize and pharmaceuticalize every aspect of our sick society, hindering fundamental change, sometimes people really are sick. And sometimes sickness consists of being at one end of the human variation, the end where your capacities aren't what you would like them to be. Researchers using single photon emission computed tomography, or SPECT, scans to study brain activity have identified clear biochemical differences between the brains of people with attention deficit disorder, ADD, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, and people without the disorders. Until now, diagnosis had relied on observation and trial treatments with Ritalin, Dexedrine, or other stimulants. Some had charged that the rising diagnosis of ADD and ADHD was a sign of America placing unrealistic expectations on kids in the schools and then drugging them to fit in. A recent consensus report from the AMA, however, concluded that probably too few American kids were being prescribed drug therapy for ADD, since it was safe and effective, and approximately 5% of kids need it, while only 3% are receiving it. Earlier studies had shown that scans can detect structural differences in ADHD sufferers' brains, as well as abnormalities in brain activity, and that scientists suspect that defects in genes relating to the brain chemical dopamine probably are involved. The latest study conducted at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston and published in last week's issue of the Lancet Medical Journal is the first to show a measurable biochemical abnormality in people with a disorder. The researchers scanned the brains of 6 adults diagnosed with ADHD and 30 healthy people of the same age after injecting both groups with a chemical that attached to the dopamine transporter. The ADHD sufferers had 30% more dopamine transporters than their healthy counterparts. The increased number could either mean not enough dopamine is floating around in their system, or that too much is being produced. But at any rate, this new dopamine transporter diagnostic is being considered as a definitive diagnostic for ADHD. Peter Singer on this show recently pointed out that the ethical tragedy of factory methods in animal husbandry. But the evidence that agribusiness is also unhealthy continues to mount, and from the spread of antibiotic-resistant strains of bugs from overtreated cattle to mad cow disease. The December 21st issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences reports for the first time a direct link between the outbreak of mad cow disease among cattle and cases of a new variation of the similar disease in people. Earlier in this decade, new variations of an infection called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease began to appear in Great Britain. The incurable disease has symptoms including dementia, muscle spasms, trembling, and vision problems, usually rapidly progressing to irreversible brain death and brain damage and death. Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease is rare, but the new variety of the illness surfaced in Britain about 5 years after the peak of an epidemic of mad cow disease, a similar illness formerly known as bovine spongiform encephalopathy. The new study has shown that the disease could have passed from cows to people. The researchers took proteins called prions from cows with mad cow disease and from the brains of people who had died with the new variety of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease and placed them in two groups of genetically altered mice. The time between infection with the prions and the first symptoms was identical in both sets of mice. In addition, the human prions and the cow prions caused the same kind of damage to the brains of the mice. In contrast, when the researchers used prions taken from sheep with a similar disease, the results were quite different. And this backs up recent studies that are coming out of the European community that show increased risk of eating certain parts of beef to the development of spongiform encephalopathy in humans. On the classic nightmare scenarios about the future, one is particularly striking, and it features a monkey from the 60s who is wired to be able to directly stimulate his own pleasure region of his brain. The monkey apparently pressed the lever until he starved. But what if we could wire ourselves just not to be depressed? Is there a problem with that? Reporting in the journal Biological Psychiatry, the firm Cyberonics reports that vagus nerve stimulation and an implanted pacemaker-like device in the brain help lift the moods of about 40% of severely depressed patients. A generator the size of a pocket watch is implanted in the chest. Wires snake up the neck to the vagus nerve, which runs from the neck into a brain region thought important for regulating mood. Every few minutes, the stimulating box sends tiny electric shocks to the nerve and thus onto the brain. The stimulator is already sold as a treatment for epilepsy. I want to just point out here that I read, I guess, 2 weeks ago, a little bit of the hedonistic imperative, and this is a document that's up on the web, David Pierce, and since I'm talking about the brain today, it's particularly appropriate. The hedonistic imperative is a manifesto at www.hedweb.com. It's a manifesto that argues that we should have as a goal of public policy the elimination of pain. And in particular, he talks about in that essay dopamine and hyperdopaminergic states and the control of dopamine as something that we should welcome and embrace. He says here, "It is possible that a more enlightened age will view our suspicion of paradise engineering as a mood-congruent cognitive pathology. Knee-jerk hostility to the prospect of genetically enriched well-being is common among emotional primitives of our era. 200 years ago, before the development of potent synthetic painkillers or surgical anesthetics, the notion that physical pain could be banished from most people's lives would have seemed no less bizarre. Most of us in the urban industrial West now take its daily absence for granted. The prospect that what we describe as mental pain, too, could one day be superseded is equally counterintuitive. The technical option of its abolition turns its deliberate retention into an issue of political policy and ethical choice." And of course, this feeds into one of the issues that I'll be talking about very soon, which is drug policy, one of the recurring issues of my show, and the need to have a more sane approach to drugs. Now, as I noted above, the capitalist medical industrial complex has an incentive to want to medicalize and pharmaceuticalize all our problems, and sometimes their goals are in sync with the goals of actual suffering people who want drugs and treatments, and radical activists such as David Pierce and his hedonistic imperative. Is it possible for consumer organizations to accept corporate backing when their goals are congruent without losing their ethical moorings? Now, this is a quote, I'm going to quote a couple paragraphs from an article in the Mother Jones, where they are more or less attacking the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, or NAMI. It says here, "The NAMI bills itself as a grassroots organization of individuals with brain disorders and their family members. According to internal documents obtained by Mother Jones, 18 drug firms gave NAMI a total of $12 million between 1996 and 1999. And these include, and then there's a long list of pharmaceutical companies. Janet Foner, the coordinator of Support Coalition International, obviously a rival to NAMI, an activist organization of psychiatric survivors, says NAMI does a good job in some areas, but argues that the group's corporate sponsors help shape its agenda. They appear to be a completely independent organization, but they parrot the line of the drug companies in saying that drugs are the essential thing. Many experts believe the umbrella term mental illness embraces a broad array of conditions with equally diverse causes. NAMI spokesman Carola says the group views mental illness as a disease like diabetes or Alzheimer's that can be treated most effectively with medications. Mental illness is a biologically based brain disorder, he says. That's not to say that other factors can't affect mental illness, but the core problem is biologically based. NAMI's critics agree that mental illness can be triggered by biological factors, but point also to environmental causes such as incest, child abuse, family dysfunction, and other traumas. NAMI's approach reduces human distress to a brain disease and recovery to taking a pill, says Sally Zinman of the California Network of Mental Health Clients. Their focus on drugs obscures issues such as housing, income support, vocational training, rehabilitation, and empowerment, all of which play a role in recovery. Furthermore, Zinman argues, Thorazine, Prozac, and other drugs routinely prescribed for the mentally ill can be counterproductive and even harmful. Namys Flynn says her group is not a captive of any outside industry, but she acknowledges that there is, at times, a synergy in goals between NAMI and the drug companies. For example, both favor so-called health care parity laws, which would require insurers to view mental illness as they do other diseases. The drug companies want more and greater markets, and we want access and availability to all scientifically proven treatments. We don't think drugs are everything, but for the vast majority, they are important. Another article that recently caught my attention in this vein is an article in Salon.com about treating schizophrenia prophylactically. And if you look up Salon.com of December 1, they quote Dr. Patrick McGorry, a professor of psychiatry at Melbourne, and his research on the use of certain diagnostic indicators of when a person is likely to become a schizophrenic, and their therapy for giving drug therapy to potential schizophrenics, and how controversial that is, because of course many people suspect that this would lead to wide overtreatment. The drugs have side effects. A patient seems sedated and have experienced 50-pound weight gains, and one of the drugs has the risk of destroying white blood cells. With an illness like schizophrenia, where the average onset is between 17 and 19 years of age, you're going to deal with a volatile time in patients' lives when it's difficult to differentiate a teenager's moods from mental illness. The mean age in McGorry's study is 20. The youngest subject is 15. McGlashan, another researcher doing prophylactic treatment, is now accepting anyone who is showing pre-psychotic signs between the ages of 12 and 45. So basically the question is, can you take a look at a teenager and differentiate a teenager who is potentially going to become schizophrenic and who therefore might benefit from taking prophylactic anti-schizophrenia drugs and not develop full-blown schizophrenia from a teenager who is just going through normal teenage angst and depression and isolation or whatever, and who will not need those drugs and would definitely be harmed by them? And that's the debate that Salon.com addresses. Definitely take a look at that December 1. And also, Salon.com also does a lot of topical articles bunched together. On December 1, they ran an article about why are there more black schizophrenics? And this is a quote from that. It took only a few weeks on the job for William Lawson to notice that there was something very strange going on. The psychiatrist had just joined the staff of John L. McClellan Veterans Hospital in North Little Rock, Arkansas, and already he had seen patient after patient, dozens of them as it turned out, with the same ill-fitting diagnosis, all African-American men, all veterans of combat in the Vietnam War. They suffered from terrifying nightmares, gut-twisting anxiety, flashbacks of fighting, classic symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, yet they'd been assigned a very different condition, schizophrenia. Lawson immediately took the men off the antipsychotic medication that they'd been prescribed, replacing it with psychotherapy and antidepressants that proved effective in relieving PTSD. Under the new treatment regime, most of the patients made a quick recovery. Mistakes like the one he discovered may be odd, but they're far from uncommon, says Lawson, now a professor at Indiana University and editor of Cross-Cultural Psychiatry. Studies going back to the 60s show that African Americans are significantly more likely to be diagnosed with schizophrenia than whites, a discrepancy due at least in part to clinician error. The rates of such mislabeling vary with the type of facility. They're much lower, for example, in hospitals affiliated with universities. But Lawson estimates that in overburdened community mental health centers, as many as 30% of black patients diagnosed with schizophrenia actually have some other illness. Of course, whites are also misdiagnosed at times, but far less frequently. Why would black people be more likely to be tagged as schizophrenics? Experts have some ideas, and the first is simple racism. While clinicians are hesitant to burden middle or upper class whites with a devastating diagnosis like schizophrenia, African American, especially lower socioeconomic status African American people, don't care as much somehow, the clinicians think. It's like, oh well, what difference does it make? We'll label them anything. Such careless or deliberate labeling has a long and ugly history. In the years before the Civil War, inflated estimates of mental illness among free blacks were used by anti-abolitionists to prove that blacks were better off as slaves. Even into the 1950s, American psychiatry maintained that blacks were too psychologically simple or too jovial to be depressed, and so diagnosed the bulk of their mental illness as schizophrenia. A second explanation is somewhat more benign. Clinicians unfamiliar with African-American culture and history may misread a black patient's signals, interpreting discomfort with an overwhelmingly white mental health institution, for example, as paranoia. The psychiatrists who had diagnosed the Arkansas veteran's PTSD as schizophrenia were unaware of the substantial role that African-Americans played in combat in Vietnam and the frequency of the disorder among African-Americans. The ostensibly objective diagnostic tools on which doctors rely may themselves be biased against blacks. Strakowski notes that the entry of schizophrenia in the clinician's Bible, the DSM-IV, instructs the diagnostician to look first for the presence of hallucinations and delusions. Mentally ill African Americans tend to have more severe psychiatric symptoms, ones that have historically been thought to be specific to schizophrenia but clearly are not. So when African Americans present with these symptoms, the clinicians tend not to notice other kinds of signs and they make the diagnosis of schizophrenia. Now, there are many different ways that mental illness affects our lives, and I found this an interesting link article here. Archives of General Psychiatry published in November. Researchers found that two-thirds of patients with body dysmorphic disorder, also known as imagined ugliness, responded to the drug clomipramine, which blocks the reabsorption of the brain chemical serotonin in cells. The drug is also used to treat obsessive-compulsive disorder, from which many victims also suffer. Victims of body dysmorphic disorder often seek multiple cosmetic surgeries, cover their face with makeup, wear wigs, and hide at home, feeling ashamed of their appearance. They also obsessively check mirrors and windows for their reflection, often upsetting themselves further. A surprising number of sufferers, 60% in the latest study, are men. One in four people with the disorder will attempt suicide. That's body dysmorphic disorder. You're listening to Dr. J. This is Change Surfer Radio. We're talking about the brain. Women with mild to moderately severe depression show alterations in their immune systems, according to researchers at Carnegie Mellon and the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. And in the research that they did, they looked at a variety of different reasons why depression affected the immune system. And I found this just personally interesting. The health practices assessed by the researchers that were most often associated with depression: increased use of alcohol, tobacco, caffeine use, nutrition, sleep quality, and efficiency, as well as physical activity. And they found that of all those, physical activity was the principal predictor of the decrease in immune system. In other words, that the principal reason why people who get depressed have suppressed immune systems is that they don't exercise when they get depressed, or they don't move around as much. Now, a link to that. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, published in JAMA last year, showed that the number of Americans considered obese, defined as being more than 30% over their ideal body weight, soared from about 1 in 8 in 1991 to nearly 1 in 5 last year. The lowest obesity rates were in New England, fortunately, and in the West, where people are more active. Younger adults, people with some college education, and Hispanics showed the most drastic increases. But a study found that a steady increase had occurred in all states in both sexes, across age groups, races, and educational levels, and regardless of smoking status. Overall, the population of obese men and women in the United States increased from 12% in 91 to 18% last year. But fortunately, medicine is on the way. Writing in the journal Neuron in September, researchers at the Oregon Health Sciences University have found that a part of the mammal brain that controls appetite and metabolism, they called the area adipostat, adipo being the prefix meaning fat, and stat, of course, for thermostat. They say it responds to injections of two chemicals, one which slows down the metabolism and builds fat, and the other which speeds the metabolism and burns fat. The area is in the hypothalamus. Now, a second piece of research, writing in Molecular Cell in September, researchers in Cambridge, Massachusetts, have found a protein lining the intestine, which is responsible for the uptake of fats from food. They are able to design drugs to block the action of this protein. Dietary fat would be passed on through, if they're able to do that. And third, the team headed by Dr. Louis Aron of Cornell Medical College, New York, reported at the recent national obesity meetings that by combining the weight loss drug Meridia with the weight-regulating hormone leptin, they had achieved a multiplicative effect on weight loss. Weight loss drugs such as Meridia can result in impressive weight loss at first, but after a period of time, the dieter often has trouble keeping the pounds off. The problem, scientists suggest, is that the drugs cause the body to think that it is in starvation mode, and it responds by burning fewer calories and boosting the appetite. The starvation response is triggered when weight loss causes a decline in blood levels of a hormone called leptin. Keeping leptin levels high by administering it along with Meridia keeps the scale moving in the downward direction. What if we can not only control our weight in the future without the Puritan disciplines of dieting and exercise, but we can also control our consciences? Dr. Antonio Damasio and colleagues at the University of Iowa College of Medicine have reported in the November issue of the journal Nature Neuroscience that they have isolated a brain structure necessary for empathy. Dr. Damasio is especially interested in how a primitive brain region involved in emotions, called the limbic system, interacts with a highly advanced brain region involved in decision-making and planning, called the prefrontal cortex. When people think about doing something, a part of the prefrontal cortex calls up knowledge related to the feelings that they have stored about similar situations in the past. These unconscious emotional signals are then used to help select the best course of action. When this region of the prefrontal cortex, located just behind the eye sockets and above the bridge of the nose, is damaged because of a stroke or other trauma, the decision-making circuit breaks down. People who suffer such injuries may fall into debt, betray their spouses, lose their jobs, or abandon their friends, but if asked in a laboratory setting to tell right from wrong, they do fine. Although such injuries are extremely rare, the Iowa researchers found two young adults who had specific damage in infancy to one or both sides of the prefrontal cortex, especially in the brain architecture there. They found that these subjects, by the age of 9, showed a general lack of motivation, had few friends, and would occasionally explode in anger. They didn't do well in school. They didn't do well with jobs. They were compulsive liars. They were dependent on their parents and seemed impervious to efforts to help them. In a test that measures moral development, both young adults behaved at the level of 10-year-olds. So another potential defense there for enterprising lawyers. The International Association of Police Chiefs voted recently in favor of taking DNA samples from every person charged with a crime that is, ethicists have charged that this is needlessly intrusive, impractical, and too expensive. DNA samples now are routinely taken from people convicted of violent crimes. The police chiefs group said that it will urge Congress and the states to pass laws that require DNA samples to be taken from all suspects, from people charged with drunken driving and shoplifting to those charged with murder. Of course, if we had such a database and we were able to run analysis on it of different kinds of genetic markers for predispositions to violence or lack of empathy, it would be quite instructive, potentially dangerous, but quite instructive. Reporting in the November issue of Nature Neuroscience, UC San Francisco researchers have identified an enzyme that could prove to be a target for reducing the craving for and the excessive use of alcohol. Now, I found the framing of this article quite fascinating because what they actually found was they found a chemical that increases a person's susceptibility to getting drunk. They found that when they gave this chemical to mice, it increased the mice's sensitivity to alcohol. Mice lacking PKC became twice as active in response to low doses of alcohol. The absence of PKC was a result of giving them the drug. They became twice as active in response to low doses of alcohol dashing around their cages, and they became more sedated in response to high doses. And since there's research that shows that people who are more sensitive to alcohol are less prone to becoming alcoholics, that is, if it just takes a little bit to get you drunk, you're not going to be drinking continuously, then this is... If you gave this drug to people who were at risk of becoming alcoholics, it would apparently lower their chances of becoming alcoholics. On the other hand, if you just wanted to buy a beer and get drunk on a beer, you could take this drug with it and just get drunk on the beer. And so it could be a tremendous boon for people getting drunk and not having subsequent liver damage and not having subsequent stomach upsets or whatever consequences of alcohol abuse result, but you'd be able to get drunk on just a little bit of alcohol. So I think that this is a tremendous boon to the drug field. Now, in the last couple minutes of this show, I want to turn to some improvements on brain cells. A team from Harvard Medical School and Connecticut-based Alexion Pharmaceuticals have transplanted brain cells from pigs into monkeys using a new process that made the neurons hold up longer under attack from the monkeys' immune systems. The idea is to come up with ways to treat Parkinson's and other diseases involving the destruction of brain cells. A few Parkinson's patients have had brain cells from embryos injected into their brains in the hopes of correcting their problems, but such cells are rare and the practice is controversial. Some scientists hope to use animal brain cells instead, but the body can recognize these as foreign cells and reject them. The researchers used an Alexion product called C5 complement inhibitor, a monoclonal antibody that is genetically engineered human protein currently being tested in human patients in phase 2 clinical trials for the treatment of various chronic inflammatory disorders. Alexion first genetically engineered pigs to grow brain cells that more closely resembled human brain cells and then produced cells that had the human complement inhibitor proteins in them. Related research in the last year has demonstrated that stem cells injected into damaged brains eventually become functioning neurons able to reverse some of the brain damage. These stem cells have been culled from embryos and then cloned in labs. Foreign stem cells can trigger immune system tissue rejection, although some research suggests that there is little immune system response to foreign stem cells. Nonetheless, the ability to generate stem cells from the damaged individual itself would be much preferable. For instance, experiments have demonstrated that stem cells culled from bone marrow can be injected into the damaged brain of the same organism, and that these also migrate to damaged areas to differentiate into the needed structures of the damaged brain. Or even better, we can find ways to stimulate the generation of new neurons in the damaged brains, since recent research has demonstrated that the brain can now grow new neuronal stem cells, which differentiate into neurons, well into old age. Okay, so for all of us who have damaged our brains over long periods of time, rats partially recovered from spinal cord injuries when they were treated quickly with a substance pumped out by immune system cells. While the rats were still impaired, the substance worked better than a drug currently given immediately after spinal cord injuries to promote recovery. That's interleukin 10. So the promotion of interleukin 10. And one more thing I want to sneak in here. Researchers at Children's Hospital in Boston have reported that they've demonstrated a simple drug with no known side effects can cause damaged spinal cords to grow back together. Benowitz and colleagues severed one side of the corticospinal tract in rats. These axons start from the motor cortex in the brain and descend to the spinal cord. They then infused inosine into the brain's motor cortex. The drug inosine caused axons to grow far along the spinal cords of rats from the uninjured side to the injured side. Axons are the long thin arms that link one nerve cell to the other. Inosine, they wrote, without known side effects, might help restore central circuitry after injury to the central nervous system. In other words, the lame may walk. You've been listening to Dr. J.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. Also, check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.